welcome to episode 6 of Girl Fight. Today, we are thrilled to have a very special guest with us, Miss Brenda Brathwaite.
Hi, everyone.
You're our first guest.
Yes.
I am.
You are.
Wow. It's yes. The honor. Thank you.
Yeah. So, Brenda, I'm just going to give her a quick introduction here. Entered the gaming industry at age 15 and has worked on lots and lots of stuff, including the popular Wizardry series for PC, which basically invented the RPG genre on PC, and now has moved into the social game space and is currently creative director at LOL Apps, which has made Facebook games based on Dante's Inferno and a couple of other properties. And in addition to that, Brenda is working on a series of, is it okay to call them board games?
Sure.
Yeah. Entitled Mechanic is the Message. And there's 6 board games that are basically about the plight of different ethnic groups throughout history. One of which, entitled Train, received the Vanguard Award from IndieCade for, quote, pushing the boundaries of game design and showing what games can do, end quote. That's a pretty impressive thing to say.
Yeah, well, I didn't expect it. I was really pretty honored by it.
Awesome. So we're going to start off like we usually do with what we're playing. Today I am joined, besides Brenda, with Jessica Chobot.
Hello, guys.
And Dana Jungle Ward.
Hi.
Christine and Megan have sat out this one. So why don't we start with you, Brenda? What games have you been playing?
I'm playing the same games I've been playing for a while. I play a lot of WoW. Mm-hmm. And I'm trying to get my current character to level 80 before the new expansion comes out.
Right.
And I play a lot of Civ Rev because I'm addicted to that stupid game.
Right.
I play it all the time.
So I'm going to interrupt and ask a question because you have twins, right?
I do.
How do you play WoW with twins?
Because
I have one kid and I had to give up my... I had to...
Well, their dad is their father's a stay-at-home dad,
that helps.
So I cheat. I mean, basically, you know, it's easy.
Okay.
And you know, also WoW hours for me are not twin hours, right?
So, right.
And also, I should say, being the mom of these kids, they are also very predisposed to wanting to play games.
Mm. Right.
So they tend to want to play with me or sit on my lap
and watch.
And watch, yeah.
Okay. Cool. I was just curious. I was like, wow.
Alliance.
I'm just putting, wow.
Alliance or Horde or both?
Alliance.
Ah.
Alliance.
Yeah. Okay. Back to what you're playing, Civ Rev, which is
Civ
awesome.
Civ Rev, yeah. And then I play a lot of board games. So when I say board games, I just mean games that aren't plugged in.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So I play Family Business a fair bit. Ticket to Ride I've been playing recently. Dominion. Oh my God, this could just go on for the rest of the hour. I play a lot of non-digital games and every manner of Facebook games. I try to play about 10 new games a day.
Wow. Mm-hmm. So how many of them do you go back to after you've played?
Maybe 1 in 10.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then that gets divided down by 1 in 10 once that 10 happens. It's really a pretty quick weeding process.
So are there any that you're still playing now, or consistently?
Somewhat consistently, I play Garden Life right now. I mean, these, you know, who knows? I play Garden Life pretty consistently. All right, I just started one. Oh, well, I can't say that. I've gone back to that one, but we'll see if I go back today and how long I go back. So I won't say that one. There's a game called SPP Ranch that I tend to go back to, which is like this little ranching game. What else is in my regular grind? For some reason, I needed Parking Wars again. Parking Wars is like old as dirt in fashion days. And I had to go back to it to get some screenshots, and I'm really tempted. I haven't played this game in maybe a year, but I'm really tempted to start it up again. So I haven't gone back to do that yet, but the temptation is certainly there. And like Parking Wars.
Oh, you're going to do it.
Me. Yeah.
Just give up the fight. You're
going to
do it.
Just go back today and start it. Yeah.
Cool. What about you, Jess?
I finally finished Splinter Cell Conviction.
Sweet.
Very messily, but I did manage. You know, I would have to say for me, those aren't my... I don't... Like I said before, I'm not a big fan, nor do I do very well at stealth games because I'm more just jump in and run and gun.
Yeah.
So it took a lot longer than I had hoped. But I thought I had fun with it, you know? Cool. I mean, I don't know if I would... It's you know, it was okay. It was okay for me. And then I actually am totally addicted to Chictionary right now on the iPhone.
Chictionary?
It's called it's a game about word puzzle placement with chickens.
That's awesome.
And
I'm totally downloading that one.
Yeah, fantastic. I am totally addicted. There's Chictionary and Get Chictionary Halloween, because then they're dressed up as Halloween characters.
Awesome.
And all the sound effects are like, bakawk, bakawk, you know, so I just have been playing that for hours. This is the one game, like, I'm not big into iPhone games really that much, but this is the one where I'll be like lying in bed, can't sleep, and so just I'm like, oh, okay, I'm gonna grab some dictionary here and start playing, and then I'm up to like 4, and then it's a disaster. I come in late for work. And then this afternoon, although I'm not playing them yet, I am planning on going to GameStop and grabbing Alan Wake and Red Dead.
Cool.
Although I'm going to play Alan Wake first, because I like horror genre games much more than the Wild West. I actually don't give a crap about the Wild West, but
I know, but
it looks interesting from other people playing, so I kind of want to check it out too.
Yep.
Yeah, just don't shoot your horse.
Christine, I don't know if you remember last week, she admitted to accidentally hitting her cow with a hammer.
Horse
with a hammer in Harvest Moon, and now she shot her horse in Red Dead.
Every single game that Christine's in, she is an animal abuser.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But it's all by accident.
Yes, not in real life.
She claims.
Yeah, she claims.
She claims.
Okay.
Okay.
What about you, Dino?
I am still not really playing much because of the move and the packing continue, which sucks into all the time. But still a lot of Picross 3D, which is the perfect commute game and also the perfect thing to play just a little bit of right before I go to bed. Doesn't get me all amped up. If you have a DS and you are looking for a new game for a trip or something, I really, really highly recommend this. Or a new commuting game. It's
hours and hours of gameplay in that.
Yep. So, Picross 3D.
I'm not even done with it yet, and I've been playing it every day.
Yeah, I have been playing it daily. So, but I also plan on picking up Red Dead, even though it's probably going to be till after E3.
You want to borrow my copy?
If I can start it. Sure.
That way, because I'll be playing Alan Wake, and I'm not going to have time to play both.
I'm not going to have.
She's not going to have time.
I'm not going to have time to touch it.
Okay. Never mind. I take it back. Yeah, you can't have it.
I could hit you up when I'm done. I'm thinking I'll pick it up because I still keep intending to play God of War 3, and the price just dropped on that.
Well, you can borrow that. I'm done with that.
Oh, okay, cool. I will borrow God of War 3. Sweet.
Awesome. There you go. And for me, I'm still playing Picross, still playing Harvest Moon, the new PSP one. It's okay. It's not as good as some of the Wii ones.
Sorry.
That was Dana opening her Diet Coke, by the way.
Get ready for a belch.
Yeah. Just like last week. And then I've also been playing Super Mario Galaxy 2, which is very cool. It's Mario. I mean, it's not really that different than the other Mario.
Don't say that to Craig.
Well, I mean, it's pretty much what you would expect. Like, it's very polished. The levels are really creative. And it's Mario, which means it can drive you crazy at some points, make you want to yell and throw your controller. But
I find that I actually swear more when playing Mario games possibly than any other game, which is rather ironic for this very family-friendly game. I was playing with my nephew, and it was all I could do not to be like, MF-er, boom.
Yeah, I think I could have given you a run for your money with Splinter Cell Conviction. After I'd gotten spotted for like the umpteenth time and I'm hanging from a ceiling rafter, I just hit the floor. I'm like, ah!
Yeah.
And my neighbors probably heard a lot of things that they don't need to hear come out of my apartment.
Yeah. Okay, so now let's segue and let Brenda do a lot of talking.
Sweet.
So the first thing that I want to ask, this was a question that came from a listener, but it was also something that I found intriguing after watching your talk at GDC online about Train. And something that you said in that was that...
Can you expand a little bit on the talk first?
Sure. So, well, why don't I let Brenda expand on the talk?
Yeah.
So you want to give a little bit of background about Mechanica's message and Train?
Yeah, sure. So I made this series, working on the fourth game in the series right now, about this series of board games about difficult topics. Mm-hmm. And so my talk was how on earth this whole series came about, which wasn't intended to be this, let me create this thing for public consumption. It was literally like, it was a design test. You know, if you're an artist, you might sketch stuff on a notebook and you don't intend to go display that somewhere, let alone release it, so to speak. But I talked about this game at a small conference in North Carolina and called the Triangle Games Summit a couple years ago. And it happened that there was a reporter there in the room, and he wrote about people's reactions to it. And so the series got accidentally released that day, I guess. So Train has gotten a lot of attention, and I'm super grateful for that and still surprised by it, frankly. And I gave a talk. It was basically a postmortem, how it came to be, what I was trying to do, how the game how creating this series of games truly made me fall deeply, passionately in love with what it is I've done for a living now for, you know, 20-some right. years. So that's what that was about.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, so the one thing that you brought up in that talk that I found really, really interesting was the fact that, you know, game developers are kind of shoehorning themselves into this games have to be fun
yeah.
category. And you don't necessarily agree with that.
I don't. No, I don't agree with it at all. And
yeah.
And I don't think, you know, I don't think we're aware of the boxes that we put ourselves into. I certainly wasn't until lots of people said, well, Train's not fun. You know, no, it's mm-hmm. it's not a fun game. Actually, like, if you take away its theme entirely, I did test the game numerous times with outcomes like we're going to Disneyland and stuff mm-hmm. like that to make sure that formally it was a good game and it was compelling and it was fun. Because otherwise, if it weren't, it would just, you know, it wouldn't hold up. But I think no other medium constrains, I don't think I know, no other medium constrains itself to this concept of it must be fun. Like, just imagine right. if all movies had to be fun, or all books had to be fun, or, you know, all songs had to be fun. This is yeah. just ridiculous. This whole world of content that we're limiting ourselves to, and our players consume tons of content that is not theoretically fun. It's super entertaining, mm-hmm. you know, and it's super engaging. You know, some of the greatest books that I've read, you know, my favorite book is Steinbeck's East of Eden. That's mm-hmm. not fun, but right. my goodness, you know, that book, like, I was glued to the pages of that book. Mm-hmm. There was a great book I read, Lonesome Dove, and I read that when I was in Hawaii. And I remember sitting on the beach. I'm in the beach in Maui, for God's sakes. Like, there should be no books around, right? I should just be. But I couldn't put the stupid book down. I yeah. started it on an airplane, and I just couldn't mm-hmm. stop reading it. So I spent my time in Hawaii and Montana in my head. You know, and I think we should expand ourselves beyond this concept of, you know, what's super fun and what's super uplifting, because there's, you know, there are all kinds of great stories to be told that don't necessarily have to be fun, right?
Right.
And I think it's important that you differentiate, too, like, you were there between fun and entertaining. Like, just because yeah. it's not fun doesn't mean it's boring and...
And yeah, entertaining not, yeah. doesn't yeah. have to equal fun either.
Right, exactly.
It can be incredibly engaging and engrossing and immersive.
Right.
Yeah. Now, do you think that happens, though, because of more larger publishers basically go and buy up these indie developers and kind of restrict them then in order to make a buck?
I mean, certainly that's true, but I don't think the restriction comes necessarily from that. I mean, we're following a lot of memes, you know, things that have worked before, and that's just market constraints. It's, yeah. you know, what's the least risky path to follow? But I certainly know when I start a game, you know, I'm sort of starting out with, you know, how can I be heroic? You know, when we look mm-hmm. at Facebook games now, a lot of Facebook games are, how can we satisfy this particular audience? And they seem to fit the same mental model. Mm-hmm. But I see them, you know, they'll expand in the future as well. So I don't know that I'd necessarily lay it at the feet of publishers. I put myself in that box for many years, mm-hmm. all on my own with no mm-hmm. help from anybody else.
Right.
Do you think it's easier to make a fun game?
I think it's difficult to make any kind of game. I've never made a game where I classified as easy. In fact, yeah. well, except one game, one of the ones in the Mechanic of the Message series, it was my Irish game, which is Shia Con Lot, which is Gaelic for Peace Be With You. That game came out of my head finished, like it was done. And I did the prototype. I just did one pass at it. It just sort of showed up finished. And I thought, well, that's how it would work. So I did a prototype of it non-digitally, of course, and played it. And it literally never changed after that. And then that'll never happen in my mm-hmm. career ever again. I mean, that never happens, right?
You were like, damn, that was it, eh? Yeah. That was my easy one.
Yeah. Yeah, and I don't know how that happened. And I even subjected it to people who I know are pretty harsh critics that mm-hmm. That have played a lot of my games. And I often use them to say, like, please tell me what's horrific with this. Mm-hmm. And they were like, no, this is done. This is great. And I was, you know, I still am waiting for somebody to point out the obvious gaping flaw. In this, you know, and it'll never happen again. I mean, that just doesn't happen.
Yeah.
I was fortunate, super lucky.
So do you see any small developers out there right now that you think are maybe making strides in making games that don't necessarily fall into that fun box? Have you seen anything out there that's...
Yeah,
that category?
Totally. I mean, you know, I think Indiecade itself, there's mm-hmm. this great little conference I went to, and that's where I was shockingly given this award. And I totally didn't expect that. I figured, like, it was digital games, right? And I actually enjoyed the whole award thing because I knew that my game wasn't in the running.
Right.
Of course it wasn't going to be anything, right? So I was actually able to sit back and not go, oh, I hope, you know?
Yeah.
And then when I got it, I just, you know, I remained stunned. I walked up on the stage. I'm never at a loss for words and had nothing to say for close to a minute. And I said thanks and sat down. But anyway, this whole conference is all about, there's a ton of different games there that are mm-hmm. not necessarily answering the question, like, how can you be the big badass superhero?
Right. Mm-hmm.
And that's super refreshing. There's tons of games that are doing that.
Yeah.
I wouldn't even know where to start.
They're just not highly visible.
Not
for
yet.
For the most part, yeah.
Yeah, not yet, but I think they're slowly becoming visible. I think there's an increasing interest in them. The fact mm-hmm. that the fact that people care enough to pack a room at GDC so I can talk about a game that's on a window with smashed glass tells me that it's definitely growing. I mean, you know, that still blows me away.
Yeah.
So maybe not this year. Maybe it's not easy for people who aren't actively engaged in the space to find it, but in another year, there will be, and I feel like gauntlets have been thrown down about, you know, are games art and can they be art? And so if you're, you know, anything like me, you probably want to answer some of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So hopefully people will be doing that. And I think within the next year, we'll see a lot more of that. And maybe even it would be awesome if we saw like a channel for games that were of that type for people to go access them. And there are channels now. I mean, certainly on the iPhone, there's all kinds of games. And I think the iPad will make things even more accessible because it's a bigger screen.
Right. Cool.
Yeah, where do you think that stuff will break through? So iPhone, anywhere else?
It's already come through, right? And I mean, games like my games are, you know, they're one of a kind, so they're not going to break there. They've already broken through, and they're sitting in my apartment. I shouldn't say that, because they actually, there's a museum. They haven't announced it yet, so I won't say who they are, but there's a museum who's asked for three of my games to be there on display.
Oh, wow.
For this specific thing that they're holding, and they'll be there for a month and a half. So that's pretty
cool. Yeah. There's the answer for games as art right there.
Yeah.
You're in a nice museum.
Yeah.
Assuming that it's an art museum.
It is an art museum.
Mm-hmm. Yes. There we go. Yes. Exclusive.
No, it's not the Smithsonian, is it? Is it the Smithsonian?
No, but...
Oh, okay. Because no, they're doing a thing, too.
They are doing a thing for games. So there will be stuff that... And I'm one of the advisors
for
their thing.
So, oh, cool.
Yeah. But I don't even think it matters. I mean, photography wasn't considered art. And, you know, there's all kinds of... that's a whole other separate podcast.
Which we already did, actually.
Yeah, we had that one.
Here we go.
Okay, cool. So Facebook games get dismissed by a lot of gamers as being not really games or baby games or all that kind of stuff. And Dana and I actually cover Facebook games as part of our job. And I totally disagree with that stance, but I assume you do as well. But what are your thoughts on the social gaming space?
Well, you know, the social gaming space, I'm just so crazy excited about it. I'm thrilled by it. And of course they're games, right? Like, I don't view games as this, you know, hardcore video games thing.
Right.
In fact, I could probably make a good argument from 1970 or so that these games that are on computers with just one player are not games. And in fact, those arguments were made back in the early 80s. And then we made the same argument when cutscenes came around. Those weren't really games, right? And I think Boston Red Sox fans would probably argue heavily that their game, despite having no electricity, is in fact a game. And the Olympics are games, and chess is a game.
Yeah.
And that just because, and that eBay itself is a single state game. You win or lose. And if you've ever lost at eBay and sworn at that screen and sworn at somebody in Idaho who got your game, whatever, you know, that's a game. And it has feedback and all these other things. And just because this type of game doesn't appeal to you, or you seem to find it, not you specifically, but because players, you know, may find it super light gaming or, you know, brainless, who cares?
Right.
It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if it doesn't appeal to you. This is a set of games that has obviously appealed heavily to somebody else, and it's about super light growing. In fact, if you took the average Facebook game right now and you added a couple levels onto it, you'd have an RTS.
Right.
All the underlying stuff, if you just, instead of like, well, I don't want to say, because then I'm giving away design stuff potentially. Like, if I ever decided to do this, like, I don't want to, like, and then I do this, and then that, right? But if you, it doesn't matter whether, what other people think of it, you know, it's brought in a whole group of players who've never before played games, and that's amazing to me. Like, my niece, and so to, just so you don't think she's, you know, 2 feet high, she's just 6 years younger than I am. And she actually sent me a text on my phone. This was awesome. Asking me if I would be her neighbor on a particular social game. And so I sent back a text like, are you F-bombing kidding me? And so this is finally, you know, this is she, her aunt has been making games forever. And it's finally a social game. And she's farming. Right. And she now actually cares that I make, you know, she's like, what games? Do you know the guys who made that game?
Well. You know,
like all of a sudden my world has come alive for her. Yeah. And so this is a group of people. When I think about women in games, interestingly enough, this is a whole group of women who potentially will expose this whole next generation of women to games where there's mm-hmm. not traditionally an in for us, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So these people may grow up, these women could grow up, these girls now could grow up to see, like, I want to make those when I get older. Good. Mm-hmm. Awesome, you yeah. know? Mm-hmm. And just because this type of game doesn't necessarily appeal to you, like, I could care less about football, but I don't right. dismiss mm-hmm. it, right?
Yeah. Right.
And I don't go like, oh, let me analyze those rules versus these rules to find out if it's actually a game. Like, who cares, yeah. right? Like, yeah. These things are, they've expanded games. This has brought us potentially a huge market that we've never had before, and people right. are having fun. Like, I'm yeah. not, you know, good, go to somebody and tell them it's not a game. Excellent. We'll just shut down faith. Like, who cares? It's yeah. just yeah. a stupid argument.
Here, here. Yeah. I agree completely.
Yes. Yes, I absolutely agree as well. So you just touched on it a little bit about women in the industry have historically and probably still been a minority. But how has that changed from when you first got into the industry?
Wow. Oh, my goodness. So, well, and I often joke with a dear friend of mine, Sherry Green Array, that we were five.
Five women.
We were five. Yeah. we go back to way back to like 81. I was fortunate in that I worked with another female developer, Linda Curry, who still does work in the industry, in fact. But Linda and I, so I didn't really have that perception that there were no other women because I somehow magically worked with one, yeah. right? But when I went to my first game conference, there were five of us, you know, and when I would go to like any women in games events, this is like really early on, right?
Yeah.
There would be, you know, maybe six of us.
That one other woman who
and
came
And I in. Knew them all. I knew all of the women by name. And in fact, it was great. I got to meet Christy Marks. We know each other, of each other. We've talked, you know, through email and through 100 different ways. But we actually met face-to-face yesterday, and it was really pretty awesome. I felt like I'd closed the basement of time, right? That I finally met the last woman that I'd never met who was there as early as I was. And now there's tons of women in the industry, yeah. comparatively speaking.
Right.
And, you know, I can go to a Women in Games event, and the room is too small, and there's, you know, there's not enough, you know, there's, I don't know everybody's name. And that's really exciting for mm-hmm. me. That's super exciting. And I, you know, I said this the other day. I am literally finally the target demographic,
right?
Game players mm-hmm. because yeah. I am a woman in her 40s.
Yeah. Like,
you know, I'm for yeah. once I'm actually wow. I am my target demographic.
You were like, that's right. awesome. Appeal to me. Yeah. Bring me games.
Yeah, that's awesome. So, what are your thoughts on sort of why women were a minority or still a minority in working in the industry?
Gosh, there's so many thoughts I have on that. You know, I think part of it goes to that, you know, we tell our friends, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we, so if most of my friends, let's say, were women, and they're not, but let's say they were, that's because I was raised in the game industry, right?
Right.
So all my friends are guys, my best friends are guys. Yeah.
We're very familiar with that problem.
Yeah. So that if one woman tells another woman, hey, guess what? There's an opening at my company, you know? Like, mm-hmm. if I just tell my friends, hey, you guys, there's an opening in testing or whatever, mm-hmm. if you're interested in coming in, then it's more likely that I'm going to be broadcasting. If you take the people in the industry, it's more likely that men are going to be broadcast to for that particular thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that's, you know, part of the problem. But when I look at it overall and I see how many women are coming into the industry. I mean, since I've been here out here in San Francisco, I've had lunch with 20 women in the industry, like at one single lunch. Yesterday there were four female game designers at a lunch, including me. And this was just I put it on Twitter. It was hysterical to me. So I see it really growing, and I think mm-hmm. what we need to do, especially women who've been in the industry for a while, is we need to feel a sense of responsibility to reach out and to broadcast to these women to let them know that, you know, I used to, and I will admit, I didn't really take it seriously. So what? I'm a woman in games. Who cares? You know, mm-hmm. I'm a woman, and I make games, and I don't necessarily see the relation. And then I would go places, and people would say, wow, I found out about you. And I'm thinking, why? You know, why is this relevant? But mm-hmm. it was because they wanted to see somebody who was like them, doing what they wanted to do. And mm-hmm. while that may not have been, well, it certainly, it wasn't even an option for me in 81, right? But if I had, when I realized that this was something that was important to other people, I started to take it seriously. And mm-hmm. that if women were interested, if they had questions in the industry, if they wanted to host a mixer, and in fact, I'm currently putting together a Women in Games mixer at the company where I work now, or just figuring out the details of it.
Cool.
That if people wanted me to do that, I was certainly going to, you know, take that opportunity to reach out to young women to tell them what the options and opportunities are. I think it's, you know, we've got some ground to cover, but there's so many women who are in the industry compared mm-hmm. to, like, this is ridiculous to me, right? There's four women in a room talking about games. I would say things like when I first started playing shooters back in the early 90s, you know, I still remember my friends showing up and I'm in my bathrobe at 5 o'clock at night because I was playing Doom all day and I was just like, what do you mean? It's five. How is this impossible? Yeah. And they looked at me like, why are you doing this? You're just running around killing shit. Yes. Yes, I am.
Exactly.
and they were just aghast that I would be doing this. And nowadays, like none of you guys would be aghast at that.
Yeah.
No, I have had the, during unemployed days, the syndrome of having to realize it gets five and that my husband's going to be home from work soon and I should put on clothes so he doesn't think I've been sitting in my pajamas playing games all day.
That's well played.
Yeah.
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 Or you can just get a job in the industry, then you can get up and get dressed and go.
And there we go. Yes. Right. That was between jobs.
Cool. Well, I'm going to segue into some of the other questions that we got from our listeners. And one of those is, which video game characters, male or female, would you give as examples of sexually empowered versus sexually exploited?
Wow. I don't know. You know, that's, I would say, wow. So my answer to that is, let's say if it were sexually empowered, any character into which you allow the player to express themselves. Mm-hmm. So if it has a chat interface, you know, I can express whatever I want through a chat interface, right? Yeah. I think because you could never create a character who would make, even if I deliberately said, this character is sexually empowered, there we are. Maybe to me, but probably not to, you know,
to everybody.
Yeah. So any character that deliberately sets out to be that is by definition also going to fail at that. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you create a shell of a character into which people can put themselves and express themselves, then you're guaranteed 100% success. Mm-hmm. So my answer is potentially a dodge, but I think it's also, I think it's the only accurate answer.
Actually, offshoot of that question that I've always found myself in arguments, not necessarily arguments, but debates in that I get that I'm curious to see.
You're arguing.
Yeah, I'm arguing. Okay, let's be honest. Yes, I am a little belligerent almost all the time. I often get emails saying, you know, well, we often see responses that women in games are often just used as sexual objects and things of that nature, even when they are main characters like a Lara Croft or a Noriko, and that women have a big problem with this. And my whole thing, because I personally don't have a problem with it, is, well, you know, you have guys that are in the same roles in major games that, you know, have six packs or 12 packs and huge muscles and can do everything, but the men don't seem to be upset about it. And now when you do have people like Noriko, she can kill a gazillion people at once and it doesn't have a problem. So do you think, like, women are kind of, or some women at least, there's a group of women that kind of are looking to complain for the sake of complaining about that kind of character?
Just like idealism of, you mean like the idealistic physique is just something that applies across.
Yeah, like genders? If you get a Noriko character and she has big boobs and a small waist, that's somehow worse to that demographic than, you know, a 12-packed guy with a huge broad chest and there's this skinny little geek playing at home, but he doesn't seem to be bothered by it.
It does. I mean, what I'm looking at is the smoking firebomb in the middle of the table. Yeah. You know, well, I picked the smoking firebomb up. So I'm going to answer this very academically. this woman I mentioned earlier, Sherry Graner-Ray, wrote a book called Gender Inclusive Game Design, which talks about hypersexualization of video game characters. And historically speaking, so isn't this a great evasion of the bomb in the middle of the table?
Who's going to touch it?
Well, I'm going to walk around the bomb many times. In her book, she talks about certain signs of sexual receptivity that we will see in female characters that will not be seen in male characters. There are certain signs of sexual receptivity, like of arousal, mm-hmm. that women have, that you can see that men, that same sense of arousal is not displayed on male characters in video games. Now, we always have the choice to play or not to play those characters. Mm-hmm. You know, there's been games, literally, where the women are walking around in basically, you know, a G-string, and I don't want to play. Like, if I want to go into the dungeon, I want to be covered, I want to be protected, I don't want, you know, a plate male G-string on. Yeah. Oh, God, this just sounds...
Well, that's
going
to protect all of you.
Come on. Yeah. Richard Harper just went +8 points. What are you talking about? It's an epic drop. Hang on.
So, although that said, like my current WoW character, and it has nothing to do with like it. When I'm just looking at my gear score, right? Mm-hmm. My gear score, I look like a stripper, but it's because my gear score is really good, and I'm unwilling to trade, right?
Right.
Yeah. So be honest then. If you knew that there was like an epic drop G string out there that matched your armor, would you put it on?
Epic drop G string. I almost spit water. That's awesome.
That was impressive, Jess. Good job.
Thank you.
That is. While I was drinking, that was great. So I don't care because I mean we already know I wrote the book on it, right? I mean you don't. But some players might.
Yeah,
and so that can be – so whenever you include something like that, you need to be aware that you could be ticking off a certain subset of players. Mm. I think the challenge comes from when women don't have those options in games. So great, you want to look hot. You know, the guys mm-hmm. look hot. You want to look hot. But can I like also – not I specifically, mm-hmm. But a certain subset of players would also like the option to not wear the epic drop – G-string.
Yeah. The
if
Mennonite
there's an
option.
Epic drop dick sock. Then we're...
Oh, my God.
Then we're even.
This is my favorite podcast ever. Oh, my God. So, yeah. So, if
some phrase.
If the... I'm not saying that.
Take the heat.
Yeah, there you go. I mean, I think it's some people can look at these games and go, God, why can't I dress normally? Why can't I dress the way mm-hmm. I want to dress? And so it's just, it's appealing to a range of players mm-hmm. Who may also be characters that that would make, you know, you want to make a certain group of players happy. And not every game is going to make everybody happy, for sure.
Mm-hmm. So you're going to have one boring game.
Hell yes. It will be a very, very boring game.
Yeah. Sims? What? No. Oh.
I love The Sims.
The only time I love The Sims is when I got the cheats and I made a character of my ex-mother-in-law.
Oh, jeez.
And I locked her in a 1x1 square. This is probably not a good thing. Yeah.
With no toilet.
No, well, yes. It took 3 real-life days to kill her.
Wow.
And I played a long time.
Wow.
And it felt great. And I really, it's cathartic. It honestly was very cathartic.
See, and it's good that you did it in a game instead of in real life.
Yeah.
Because that would have been a much worse for you.
Yes.
There you go.
Alrighty, cool. So we got kind of a jokey question here. Would you consider Miss Pac-Man a strong female role model?
Would I consider? No. I don't. Like, especially because, you know, she eats all the time, and we can't necessarily say whether those are pills or those are just constant food, right?
Never thought of them as pills.
Me
neither. That really changes
the... There was a whole controversy back when those games came out that they were gobbling pills and promoting... Oh, it was ridiculous.
My Lord.
Yeah. I mean, the controversies in
games
are
raver.
Just absurd. Yeah, so no, I don't... I mean, she's got a bow on her head, which I just don't advocate for starters.
Right.
And then she's got...
It's pink.
And it's
pink. That's just my thing.
Yeah. No, for eating constantly, yes, she would be a great role model.
Okay. This is obviously, we knew this one was going to get asked. What advice would you give to a young woman interested in finding her way into the industry but might be apprehensive entering into a fray of scrutiny that the gaming world might tend to place on a girl gamer?
Well, first of all, don't care. Don't care about the scrutiny. You know, if somebody's got a problem with you, good. Let them own it. Let them have it. You know, hopefully they will just sequester themselves off of their problem and say stupid stuff. So I don't even care about that sort of stuff. If you want to enter the industry, and this applies to men or women, start making games now. Mm-hmm. Absolutely start making games now. Like right now I'm learning how to code. Not because I'm going to school or whatever, because I forgot how to code. I used to know how to code a long time ago. So I'm learning C++ right now because I want to be able to make some small games on my own without having to get a programming team.
Right.
And because I feel it limits me as a designer. And I'm not doing this because I have to, and I'm not going to school for this. I'm just starting now. And that's like the board games that I made. You know, just start making games wherever you are. I don't care how old you are. My kid made her first game at 5. So, I mean, granted, her mom's a game designer, so she's probably seeing this stuff around more than normal. But start making games now. And then if you are a woman, I recommend you get involved with, you know, the IGDA, the International Game Developers Association, has a Women in Games, SIG. Get involved with the mailing list. Introduce yourself. This is a really friendly group of women that, you know, will, you know, help you. You know, you may find a mentor there. You'll certainly get lots of advice and lots of suggestions. There's also a group, Women in Games International, that hosts mixers around. Mm-hmm. If you're in a big metropolitan area, you can look for women in technology groups. There's lots of networking, and I actually find being a woman in games is advantageous because it does give me these unique networking opportunities that I may not otherwise have. Like, I can go to the game developers group of name the city, whatever.
Right.
But this is like these additional bonus opportunities that aren't available to everybody else. And the Women in Games community, we are small and we are well-networked and we all know each other. I mean, certainly at least at some level, we all know each other. We're all one phone call removed from everybody else, or at least one person removed from everybody else, maybe. But I feel like it's easier now to reach out and to network with people, you know, particularly with Facebook and Twitter. Mm-hmm. You know, check my Twitter feed and you'll see that I follow a lot of women who are game developers.
Right. Yes, and we'll be posting Brenda's Twitter and her blog and everything on our Facebook page and stuff. But you said your daughter just made a game at 5.
Yeah.
You made your first game at 5
I did,
as well.
And nobody cared.
Okay, what was it, though? I'm curious.
So I made this Lego. I made an entire level out of Legos.
Awesome.
And there were things that were happening, and I wasn't aware that I was making a game. And I mean, I still use pretty much the same level design process minus the Legos. Although that would be hot. If I had enough Legos to make an entire level for a role-playing game, that would be awesome. So I made this entire thing, and I remember it was at a Thanksgiving dinner. And I created this entire level out of Legos, and I tried to get people to come and play it. Like, come on, okay, we start here, and then we're going to go from here to here, and nobody wanted to play. But it didn't dissuade me, and I just kept making them. Eventually, I transferred to graph paper.
Awesome.
But, yeah. Awesome. But that was my first game.
Okay. This might be a super easy question to answer or a super hard one. So if you could come up with any video game that you wanted to, knowing that a publisher would back it no matter how silly or anything, what sort of characters would you create and what would the storyline be? So basically no limitations.
No limitations. See, this assumes that I'm not going to make it, right?
Right.
I mean, there's some topics that... So the one that's actually... This is a terrifying question. Yeah. I'm so tempted to say, I desperately want to make this. Somebody please phone me.
Yeah.
I would say there are some things that are really near and dear to me, so I'm not going to answer the one that's right in the center of my head.
Okay.
But there are some IPs I would love to work in. Again, I'd love to make another Wizardry game.
Cool.
You know, that would just be such a blast. I would... and that would, of course, require somebody to purchase the IP to be able to do that, and then pay me to do it, and pay an entire team to do it. I really love Irish history, and I would. I feel like that whole area is not nearly as well touched as it could be. I would love to be funded to just make board games for a year. That would be awesome. Although, you know, I funded myself to make board games for 3 years, so I don't know what I'm talking about there. I guess I already am. So there, that one's solved.
Yeah.
Done.
Yeah.
What else do I don't know. Those are the ones that come to mind. And there's so many things in Irish history that I could do. I would love to make... Oh, this is one. I was just talking about this morning. I would love, and I considered doing a PhD on this as well. I would love to make... the modern day version of the Gaelic games. So back in Ireland, they introduced these things called the Gaelic games to help reintroduce Gaelic culture to Ireland after it had been virtually exterminated by a series of laws. And I won't go into that whole piece of Irish history. But they used games to reintroduce this. And I thought, wouldn't it be interesting if we could do that here in America, so that children and even adults who were of Irish descent thought of their culture and their history more than just St. Paddy's Day and getting trashed, which isn't a part of their culture and their history per se. And so creating a modern day Gaelic games that was fun and not, you know, didactic and, you know, hideously boring, that reintroduced their culture so they knew what it meant to be Irish and they knew what it meant to be Irish American. That would be pretty awesome.
Yeah.
Was Boadicea cool. Gaelic?
Hmm?
Was I think I might be pronouncing it wrong. The warrior queen?
I don't know.
There's whole areas of WoW that are based on Gaelic mythology.
Hmm.
She seems like an obvious choice for a hardcore woman character. Mm-hmm. That would, if she is, I'd have to look up the history on her.
The best Irish pirates were women.
Really?
Yes, absolutely.
I'm trying to remember. There was in my Childcraft, we had a whole pirate section, and they had some women pirates in there, and I'm trying to remember the names of any of them right now, and I can't.
And then there's all the druids.
Mm-hmm.
All kinds of stuff.
Cool.
Bring on.
I'm like,
yeah. What?
That would be really cool, yeah. Actually. Did you ever read Lou of the Silver Hand?
No.
It's really good. And it's all about like, well, I mean, it's obviously kind of a fantasy story, but it kind of all is based off of like a druid / Gaelic.
Nice. Mm-hmm.
And it's just, I remember it in college, it's a 3-parter. I only remember the name of the first book. I read all three, but it was, it went really, as far as I could tell, because I'm not very educated in that genre, but it was really intense and really intriguing. You should check it out.
Yeah, I will.
We always have at least one book recommendation per podcast.
There we go. I will definitely check it out.
Yeah. I want to go back to something that you touched on as well about kind of the difference between working alone and with a team.
Mm-hmm.
So are there big differences there?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I mean, there's huge differences team to team, right?
Right, yeah.
And especially, you know, the largest team I ever worked on, I was one of 6 senior designers reporting to a, I don't know what
Uber happened. Senior designer.
Yeah, super senior, super designer.
Super senior.
I was reporting to him, and there were just bazillions of people, it felt like, under us. So I never felt like I was in the team was too big to feel that you were a part of this thing. And then I worked in, you know, really small teams, like, you know, the Wizardry and Jagged Alliance teams were certainly not gigantic by any stretch of the imagination. And today on Facebook, the teams are like, they're, you know,
teeny tiny.
Yeah, yeah. They're back to like the old days, which is really pretty exciting, where you can have your stand-ups in a single room, and it's awesome. There's huge difference. And then working by yourself, it's especially on these board games, right? The process is very different. But I spend a lot of time with them. The one I'm working on now, One Falls for Each of Us, you know, I'm making it all by myself, and which is, you know, I don't know if you know the scale of the game. There's 50,000 pieces.
Right. This is the Cherokee, the Trail of Tears.
Yeah.
Last one.
Yeah. No, it's more than the Cherokee, but it's about the Trail of Tears. And so it's an often very meditative process. I mean, that's what game design is primarily. It's thinking and then expressing those thoughts through either code or, you know, in my case, these pieces for this board game.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, you know, it's incredible. I love designing by myself because it forces me. Well, I loved it. You know, I love game design. Yeah. I don't really care like it's different. The thing I love about the designing by myself is it forces certain decisions on me that I would normally outsource, so to speak, to artists, you know, like, all right, I need this to be whatever. And whenever you give some of that away, you are, you know, letting some of your responsibility go. Like the Irish game, I obsessed over the colors. Like it had to be just the right green. And I made so many little armies of Irish people that they weren't the right color green. And so they just had to go. And then deciding exactly the right color that I was going to use for the Native Americans, deciding exactly the right number that I was going to use. And I decided that the reported numbers on the Trail of Tears are probably lies, since many of the numbers reported back then are.
Yeah.
And so I just decided that the number that I'm going with is probably a safe number.
Mm-hmm.
And it may turn out not to be, you know, and in which case I'll up it. But I'm not going to go under with it.
Right. 50,000 pieces.
I can't even tell you how insane this is. But it's awesome, right? You know, like every single one of them, every single one of them in the process, I will touch them at least 3 times. And so I'm literally making a direct connection to every single one of those. And it's now overwhelming. They are starting, literally, they're consuming my apartment.
I was going to say, where do you keep them all?
They're all at my apartment.
Okay.
And, you know, I can send you some pictures of them.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm making, I'll probably make another 5,000 this weekend. And
What do you make them out of?
So they're wood. I don't make them. They're specially milled. But you can see, like, the dye is still in my fingertips, no matter how much I try to get it off.
Wow.
But which is great. You know, I think it's good to walk around with that mm-hmm. sense of this game, because I'm constantly thinking about it right now. Mm-hmm. And since it's all in my head and I'm not giving it to some artist or some programmer, it forces this very intimate connection with games and game design and the concept and the people you're representing. Mm-hmm. There's a huge sense of responsibility, because if you screw something up, the finger's coming directly at you. And when you're dealing with subject matter like this, which is, you know, it's just incredibly painful. I feel mm-hmm. this tremendous responsibility to do it absolutely right. Fortunately, I don't have a ship date, right? So it doesn't matter when I'm... Well, actually, yeah. I do, because this has to be in a museum. But the ship date, I wouldn't have agreed to it unless there was, you know, tons of room. And if it forced me in any way, shape, or form, like if I get to the day that it's supposed to be there mm-hmm. and I'm not comfortable with it and I don't feel it's right, it's not going to be there. Uh-huh. You know, and I'm tough. I want it to be exactly the way it's supposed to be.
And when did you start this again?
This one was started, the whole series starts, I can't remember, in 2008 I start working on this series, and this one I started October 23rd of last year.
That's an incredibly long amount of time to work on it. Did you ever feel kind of bored?
No.
Always kept your interest.
Yes. Yeah. It's. I honest to goodness, I feel it's a gift. I mean, I feel it's an absolute gift. I mean, I'm not dealing with pleasant topics, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, but I'm also it's really opened up my eyes to, us as humans, you know, right. and what we put each other through, and the common systems that underlie tragedies, not just today, but going all the way back through time.
How extensive did you do your research? Did you actually go and interview any Native Americans, or did you pretty much stick to, like, I guess, for lack of a better term, history books, even though, like you said, that things were lied.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Yeah. So the design process for these games is pretty different. It's super organic. And, you know, it's what do I need to know and where do I need to be? And I've been to Oklahoma, which is, you know, that's the...
Right.
I've been there many times. I've been through Oklahoma many times. I'll give you an actual... Since this game is still... The Trail to Tears game is still in production, I don't know necessarily where I'm at in the research process, because mm-hmm. I could be literally in the beginning and unaware of it.
Right.
I may think that I'm here. But with Train, and I never would have predicted this at the beginning, there was this picture of these two boys... with these little Stars of David, which were hand-cut by parents on them, by their, you know, I'm assuming their mom, and they're the cutest little kids, and they're sitting there, and they've got these hand-cut stars, which are a little bit frayed, and these two boys are going to go to an extermination camp, and I know this, they, of course, don't know this, and their mom may know this when the picture's taken. It's a fairly famous photograph, and I stared at that picture every single day for months. Every single day. And I don't mean just like looked at it for 10 minutes. I mean sat in front of it for an hour at least and imagined that those were my kids. And I wanted to try to feel as much as I could feel. And so that was this, you know, we know, many of us know a lot of things about the Holocaust. And I've learned probably more about it since I finished making Train, just because when people approach the game that's on a window with smashed glass with yellow people getting into boxcars, to me this screams Holocaust. Mm-hmm. And it's not like the Holocaust happened 600 years ago.
Right.
And this is a recent event, and that people approach this and they don't know what it's about. You know, that's telling us a lot. Like, wow, mm-hmm. what are we not teaching people, that this is all, every single part of the game is a symbol of the Holocaust. And that we are not aware of that. Many people are not aware of that. When they see that, tells us something. So anyway, I'm digressing from the main question, which was mm-hmm. this picture to me and the emotions that were inherent in that I felt through this picture is something that I really wanted to feel while I was making the game. Whether that came out in the game, I don't know. I mean, I don't know necessarily that there's a correlation one-to-one. I mean, obviously, I did the, you know, what are the numbers? And the number, the math of the Holocaust is heavily represented in Train. It's everywhere. Mm-hmm. And so the research process is different for every single game. But, you know, another game that I'm working on called Mexican Kitchen Workers, which is about illegal immigration, and that's will probably be the fifth game in the series. I've done five prototypes of it already, and I took it. It could have gone in two directions, and I took it in this direction, which was obviously not the right one. So we're back here now. That game, I've done a ton of research on that. You know, just with the Mexican immigrant population.
Do you ever get tempted to just walk away for a while? I mean, that's intense stuff. You're looking at on a very regular basis.
Well, you don't get that choice with game design, right? Like, you know, it's not like, especially if it's not plugged in game design. I mean, you know, my brain thinks about it incessantly. And, you know, just like when I was working on the last big Wizardry game I worked on, I had to live with this stupid notebook everywhere. Like in my car, I had a notebook that was written on like half sideways because, you know, it doesn't like, hey, are you, it's like, I feel like game design's job is to go, oh, hey, you're in the shower. I notice you have no way to write anything down. I have a fabulous friggin' idea for you, right? Or like 3 o'clock in the morning, you wake up with something. And if you don't write it down, it's sick. And sometimes you wake up at six having written down this garbage at three and you're like, what?
What?
Like, that's the stupidest idea ever. But you never know when it's going to show up. And, and so, no, it doesn't. It's a draining. It's, I mean, the topics are not pleasant, but they're real and they're okay. And I think it's, you know, I don't feel it's a bad thing. I mean, it's not, you know, I've certainly known worse pain in my own life than than the pain that these things or the, you know, the difficult topics, the challenge in approaching the difficult topics.
Do you know yet what the sixth game is going to be about?
Yeah, I do. The sixth game is called City Soleil. I'm pronouncing that horrifically. My apologies to anybody who speaks French who's listening. It's about day and night life in Port-au-Prince, Haiti. And this is before the earthquake. So basically, and this will be a super fun game design challenge. And by super fun, I mean super engaging. I'm creating a game that it's one game, but it's synchronous. It's going to feature synchronous and asynchronous play in two games being played simultaneously on the same board using the same pieces, but different levels of the game. And it'll be played, like I said, it's synchronous and asynchronous. It's a huge game design challenge, and I'm not really even sure how to approach it fully yet, but when I get there, I'll get in and do it.
Awesome. We've got one more question here. It says, do you find that sex has become more prevalent in modern gaming, and do you think it will ever come to the point where there will be mainstream games made specifically for sexual content?
I mean, there are already lots of games made specifically for sexual content, so that day has arrived. we have been there for a while. Do I think? Give me the beginning part of the question again.
Has it become more prevalent?
No, no. I mean, games with sex in it that goes back to the early '80s, and in fact, if we want to take games that were played over university servers, like games like Shades, I think it was called, where you could get a private area. It was the first game that allowed you to have a private area, so just two people could chat, and the administrators could not view what they were chatting. You know, chat interface plus game plus internet connection equals sex. So eventually that'll happen. So I don't feel like it's more prevalent. I feel like we can talk about it more. In fact, I would say it's probably less prevalent because of because the rating system, is skewed, at least in America, towards sexuality. So we have less games that are actually sexually explicit than we used to. If you look in other cultures, their rating system is skewed heavily toward violence. So, I mean, the question would be more interesting. Do you think that we'll have games less skewed toward guns and whatever? And then
Well, what do
not
you
as
think?
Long as the NRA has something to say about it.
I mean, it's just too easy. Mathematically, that's too easy, and it's too fun to blow stuff up. So probably not either.
Awesome. Well, did you want to see if you got any questions?
I don't even know if it posted.
For
I was having
Twitter
trouble.
Account?
Let's see.
We have a sporadic, spotty AT&T connection here in our building. It's a pain in the butt.
I hate AT&T. Just tossing it.
But I love my iPhone.
I do. Oh, man.
Nothing.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't think I don't think my question posted.
Well, cool. Did you guys have anything else?
No, it's been... Well, has your board game designing and then non-board game designing, do they inform each other, or are they pretty similar for you? I mean, what do you learn from one that you can apply in another, or do you approach them the same way?
Well, the approach is really the approach is certainly very different. In that I'm trying to satisfy a different customer, and that I can say no. It'll be done when I say it's done, and I don't I don't have to worry about a publisher or, you know, massive social media or platform constraints and all that other stuff.
Or market testing.
Or market testing. Yes, none of that matters. But the one super way it has informed it is, you know, we talk, among game designers, we talk frequently about this concept of making meaningful choices, giving the player meaningful choices to make so that you don't just go, would you like to kill yourself or move forward down this path, right? And,
right.
And so that they actually feel like, wow, if I make this choice, then, you know, I wonder what might happen, and that they're actually rewarded with different things happening depending on which way they go. And so for me, the whole thing that came out of this especially Train, was not making meaningful design decisions so that literally every decision I'm making, I know why I'm making it. I've considered every single thing deeply. There's a few designers, there's three designers that I talk to a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, sometimes if I'm not sure, I will check with them, like, what do you think about this? And really, you know, taking tremendous responsibility for the design decisions that we make. And, you know, sometimes that has meant I've been, you know, on some forums, you know, where people have not played Train, or, you know, are not really familiar with it and just know the subject matter these games are covering, they'll, you know, it's been flame bombs, right? Mm-hmm. And I take responsibility for that. Or other people who have been upset that I am making games about a culture that is not my own. You know, fine, stick with the Irish game, go ahead, mm-hmm. but you've got no right to explore these other cultures. And, you know, so that is also part of the responsibility, you know, do I or don't I? But I also understand that, you know, it can be really upsetting to people. There have been people who've walked up and seen the typewriter in Train, which is a real Nazi typewriter. And there's been people in, they've cried. So I'll finish mm-hmm. that sentence, yeah. And they've just cried. They're just like, oh, my God, this is too much. And I hate the typewriter. It's in my apartment. It's mm-hmm. in fact, it's in a closet, and I hate it. But, you know, it was the only, if you were going to type the rules of carrying out this game, where else are they going to come from? And once mm-hmm. that idea occurred to me, like, really, the rules of a game are the heart of a game. That is what a game is. It's mm-hmm. the rule set. And if you are going to print that out on a laser printer and hand it to somebody, like, what service? Like, that should be, you know, in non-digital games, that is the core. And mm-hmm. in, you know, video games, the code is the core. And if those things aren't perfect, then forget it. How they've most informed each other is it's really made me deeply consider every single design decision. Deeply consider how I want the player to feel. If I want the player to feel fun, if I want the player to come back and play, you know, in a little while, if I want the player to feel like they really did some social action with their friends, this is an area that's kind of fascinating to me right now, like feeling true socialization as opposed to, you know, I go to your page, I go to, you know, right. just on the friend grind, and I mm-hmm. go to your page, like, you're not there. But what could we do that really would be truly socializing with one another in, you know, like, if we played a board game among four people, what if we played a board game among 100 people, except maybe not a board game.
Right. Yeah,
but
right.
if there were true socialization. And really thinking
just think
about
of all the
that.
Pieces you'd have to make for 100 people.
Well, there's still got 50,000. Yeah. I'm pretty far along there.
Yeah.
If you had to pick your favorite video game that you've ever worked on, which would it be?
Wizardry 8,
standard?
Without a doubt. Yeah, Wizardry 8 was absolutely a labor of love. And I still miss it. I miss the characters from the game sometimes. I know that sounds absolutely crazy, but sometimes I miss the characters.
Have you ever
Didn't you kill them all on the end of that game?
I did. Yes, now that you bring that up, I did kill everybody. I mean, we weren't intending that to be, that wasn't necessarily going to be the end of the series, but it was just, we'd worked with the same, in the same universe for the last three games, and I needed a convenient way to mop the whole thing up, because I just wanted to start the next Wizardry from a brand new place. And so, uh-huh. yeah, the universe goes at the end. Yeah, so I did. I missed them. I killed them. That's kind of a funny follow-up. Yeah.
Have you talked to anybody that potentially you could partner up with so that you could buy the IP of the game?
Well, the IP was, I mean, the Saratech family owned the IP, and they sold. I don't know where it went, but I talked to, you know, Linda all the time. You know, and it's funny because it was just on Twitter. Somebody kept talking, not somebody, but several somebody said, like, geez, Brendan, it would be great if you guys made another Wizardry game. And so I was like, yeah, well, whatever, it would be great. Mm-hmm. And I'd made so many role-playing games, I was just happy to be making something without swords. Just no swords, just for a while. Yeah. And then, funny enough, like, there was enough of this sort of regular poking that I was like, yeah, it would be fun to make another Wizardry game again. You know, and the series is still going on in Japan, you know, it's still popular over there.
Right. Have you played any of those?
I have, yeah. Yeah, they're more the JRPG style.
Okay.
You know, which of course was that whole style evolves because of Wizardry, right?
Yeah.
And I should say, like, Wizardry, you know, it the invention of the RPG, you know, goes way back. You know, it even predates Dungeons and Dragons. So Wizardry wasn't the first, certainly. And even Akalabeth, as much as I hate this, Akalabeth beat Wizardry to the computer, you know, just by a little tiny margin. So we can't even take that credit as much as I would love to.
Right. It's cool. Oh, I did have one other question here I have written down. Right now we're starting to see a huge influx of games that are targeted at women that are basically hidden object games, sort of with a romance or relationship shell put around them. And obviously they're popular because they wouldn't keep making them if they weren't. But us in this room, we've talked about it a little bit. We kind of feel like there's a little bit of a disconnect there. Like this is being shoved to women because publisher or whomever just thinks that that's all that they want to play. So are you familiar with those games? Or
I am, yeah, I'm familiar with them. I mean, ultimately, money will talk, right?
Right.
And, you know, and there's, like, I could not fathom reading a Harlequin romance novel. I cannot even imagine. And I think the fact that the four of us are sitting in this room, we have already ostracized ourselves in some sense that we are, you know, we've self-identified.
We are not their target audience.
We are not their target audience, right? So when I play those games, I think, oh, my goodness, you know, like, but... You know, ultimately money will tell. And I think we're still trying to figure out what this female, you know, I mean, that would be ridiculous if we said the male demographic, I guess. But what a certain subset of players, what women really like in games. I mean, this really right now, this is like the holy grail that we've, I mean, the women who are playing games that have come in through Facebook is just astounding. This is unprecedented. I mean, we thought the Wii was opening channels. The Wii, like, opened a tiny little stream compared to what Facebook has done. So, I don't know. Like, I think the market will bear it out. Will I play these things? No. I mean, I'll play them because I try to play 10 games a day. But will I play them, like, actually, like, oh, awesome? No. Not a chance.
All righty. Cool. So, how are we on
time? We are just about to end.
Okay.
Yes.
Well, we're going to wrap it up. Thanks so much, Brenda.
Thanks
for joining us.
Great.
As always, listeners, if you have questions, comments, feedback, you can send them to IGNGirlFight@gmail.com. You can also like us on Facebook, facebook.com/IGNGirlFight. And you can follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/IGNGirlFight. And Brenda is B. Brathwaite on Twitter.
Yep.
And your blog address?
BrendaBrathwaite.com.
BrendaBrathwaite.com. We'll post all this stuff, too, so that so you can get to it and have further interaction with Brenda. But thanks again.
Awesome.
It's been awesome. And we will be back next week with a regular Girl Fight episode.
Awesome. Farewell.
Sweet. Bye.
Bye. Boobs.